Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our guest is Dr. Thornburg. Christopher Thornburg is the founding partner of Beacon Economics. He's an expert in the study of regional economies, real estate dynamics, labor markets, and business forecasting. Prior to launching Beacon, he worked with UCLA Anderson Forecast, where he regularly authored the outlooks for California, LA, and the East Bay. And he also received his PhD from the Anderson School at UCLA. Dr. Thornburg, we welcome you to our show.
Great to be back.
I think the most often heard phrase in 2008 was, "not since the Great Depression." Was it accurate or an exaggeration?
More or less an exaggeration. When you sit down and look at what's been happening in our economy, certainly on the financial market side of things, you have seen some pretty extraordinary changes in the market. Of course, we had that 40% decline in the stock markets in the last three, 4 months of the year. You lost Fannie, you lost Freddie. Financial turmoil like nobody's business. But when you take a step back and look at the rest of the economy, and look at the sort of the flows of the economy rather than the value of the assets, I think 2008 was not a good year, but it wasn't remarkably bad either. We had a slight negative in the third quarter, of basically zero growth, and then the first quarter, a pretty good jump in that second quarter. We haven't gotten fourth quarter numbers yet. My guess is when the numbers do finally come out, you'll probably see GDP contracted on a seasonally adjusted annualized basis about 3.5%. In the third quarter, fourth quarter. So overall, you know, kind of bad year, but, you know, certainly nothing historic.
Okay. Well, what are the benchmark numbers that officially let you know, yep, we're in a depression?
Well, there is no such thing as a quote-unquote depression. In fact, what's interesting is if you go back prior to World War II, all recessions were called depressions. Nobody ever referred to them as recessions.
Okay.
The term recession came into use really after World War II because they wanted to talk about an economic downturn, but they didn't want to say the word depression because depression brought back these images of, you know, 25% unemployment.
Exactly.
And the kind of hellacious situation that was going on in the U.S. economy in the 30s. Technically speaking, there's no difference between a recession and a depression. There's no particular point at which, quote-unquote, it becomes a depression. What you could probably can say is a depression is just a very, very bad recession, and by no stretch of the imagination have we gotten to that point, at least by this point in time.
Okay. Do they calculate unemployment the same as they used to? And the reason I ask, I noticed that there were they have the unemployed, and now we have the people that have given up, and then the category of people that are working part-time that would work full-time if they could. And if you add those numbers up for California, you start approaching somewhere in the mid to upper teens for those three groups.
Yeah, but you know what? When you talk about the 25% unemployment back in the Great Depression, that is as defined as we currently define it, which is people who want jobs but can't find them. We always have people who are quote-unquote underemployed. We always have people who are discouraged workers. Those are also cyclical. But, you know, if you talk about, say, the unemployment rate here in California being a little over 8%, which is what it is today, and then you go back to, say, the mid-90s when unemployment in the state of California had hit 10%, that unemployment number I just gave you is exactly the same. And what that means, of course, is, yes, there's unemployed people in California. Yes, they're discouraged workers in California, but there were back in the mid-90s as well when things were really tough back then.
The financial meltdown where we literally saw one giant Wall Street company after another bite the dust, did you ever think you would see that in your lifetime?
Well, I did, but of course I did about 6 months before when I saw sort of the writing on the wall, particularly for Fannie and Freddie. The game they were playing over the previous 10, 15 years was extremely dangerous. These companies had leveraged themselves up to a degree that was just, you know, realistically, it was completely unsustainable, and I would even call it close to being criminal. what you have, of course, is circumstances with these companies, because of the implicit guarantee of the U.S. government, were able to just borrow like companies shouldn't be able to borrow. And they had a debt-to-equity ratio. Once you put preferred stock in debt where it should be, they had debt-to-equity ratios of 80 to 1. Now, the reason that that is so unbelievably dangerous is because any sort of turmoil and your company's gone.
Now, does that literally mean if you had a 1.25% loss, you both basically were underwater?
You got it.
Okay.
Yeah, equity is completely wiped out.
Wow.
Common equity. Obviously, preferred would still stay in place. But preferred is, like I said, is legally and financially much more like debt than it is sort of common equity. Now, the key here, of course, is we start thinking about, you know, leverage. And you ask, why would they do that? Well, understand that the issue of leverage is this, is you leverage yourself in order to magnify your profits. The more leveraged you are, the more returns your equity holders have. The problem is, of course, that magnification goes in two directions. It not only intensifies gains in good times, but also intensifies losses in bad times.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason, of course, they were leveraging themselves to that degree is because, if I hit right and times are good, my management team is going to walk away with just ridiculous bonuses because things are so wonderful on the profit side. However, on the back end of that, if things should fall apart, well, you know, who cares? Uncle Sam's going to pick up the bill. Heads I win, tails you lose. That's a bad incentive system, and, of course, that's what handed us this big mess.
You know, talking about bad incentive system and a bad system, we all thought we had safeguards built into where we had something rated AAA by a company that was supposed to be kind of separate and aloof from the system, and then we come to find out that they were being paid commissions or fees by the very people that needed the ratings. That's scary.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there's two sides to that. One side, of course, is that people who listened to Moody's and S&P need to have a better understanding of who they're listening to. I mean, these organizations don't see all. They don't know all. They do the best they can to determine the risk of these assets. But you're talking about a whole new class of assets that had really never been studied in the long term before. And so really all their understanding was based on modeling, not an actual history.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and let the buyer beware to some extent on this. For people to sort of so mindlessly assume that because S&P says this is safe, it's safe, well, you know, you just can't have that level of trust today.
Well, now what you just said, though, that's very significant because we kind of thought we could. There's got to be, at some point, you have, okay, this is an opinion we can trust, and if it's not at that level, I guess we don't have trust.
Well, or more specifically, you know, people have to know, all investors have to know, first and foremost, that they have to do their own due diligence. And I mean, this is a very standard thing. When times are good, investors forget to do their due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
They get excited. They start going crazy. I mean, we saw that during the dot-com disaster where, you know, people weren't looking at the fundamentals of these companies. They weren't paying attention to their business plan or more specifically, lack thereof. The fact that whatever model they did have was clearly failed. They just didn't. And this time around, we saw the same sort of abuses, not only when it came to sort of the AAA bonds, but also, you know, in terms of due diligence on thinking about loaning money to companies. You know, you saw the use of covenants in these debt just collapse. Nobody was using covenants anymore. Nobody was using, you know, various sorts of protections that investors should always ask for when they're lending to money. You're a lender. You know how you're supposed to remember to do things. And more importantly, they were willing to lend 95%, 98%. You know, first rule of lending is you got to make sure the person you're lending to has some skin in the game.
Absolutely.
So, you know, across the board, people forgot to do their homework. And you know what? I tell you what. Here is the most, I think, galling example of people not doing their due diligence, and that, of course, is Bernie Madoff.
Yes.
This guy ran a Ponzi scheme for decades.
Yes.
And nobody looked.
Yeah, you do think, and I go back to what you think the SEC probably is supposed to do. How do you get away with that under the nose of what is supposed to be scrutiny, especially if you're dealing with Is it $50 billion?
Well, it was $50 billion that the fund was supposed to be worth.
Yeah.
But, of course, most of that, quote-unquote, worth was based on returns that never actually occurred.
Yeah,
but not the amount of money people actually put into it.
Yeah, but if you get your statement every day or every month or quarter and it says a certain number in your head, that's what you're worth, and you kind of spend
like that.
Well, you live like that.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I'm not arguing that for a second, but I guess my point is
It's not the principle
involved. It's actually a smaller amount than that. But it's a galling example.
Absolutely.
No matter how you look at it.
Well, okay. Now let's talk about beyond the borders of the United States. When our problems occurred, it seemed to take with it the entire world's financial stability. You know, why did that occur?
Well, again, you gotta be a little bit careful about that statement. That's a very, very big statement.
Okay.
And the reason I say you have to be careful about that is not so much that we brought down the world. The problems in the U.S. economy were not isolated to the U.S. economy. We weren't the only country that had a massive real estate bubble. I mean, you look at the United Kingdom, you look at Ireland, you looked at Australia, you looked at Spain. I mean, Spain's real estate bubble makes ours look moderate. The kind of price increases you saw in the Spanish economy over the last decade are totally insane. So we weren't the only place that saw this kind of crazy credit, this crazy lending going on. Certainly, we are the financial 800-pound gorilla on the block, if you will.
Right.
I mean, we're 25% of the world economy. Our financial markets are probably 50% of the world's financial markets. And so you see the problems here, and they're the biggest and the loudest, and, of course, everybody takes note of that. But do bear in mind that we weren't the only place that saw these kind of abuses going on. It was many parts of the world that had these crazy abuses going on. And same with even lending into Eastern Europe, for example. I mean, the kind of borrowing going on in Eastern Europe with no controls, things that development economists rail against. They know is bad. For example, you have an economy that has a currency that's going up, and everybody's investing in that economy, and a lot of people in that economy are borrowing a foreign currency. This is the kind of thing that Mexico was doing in the early 90s. And when it blew up, it just makes the pain so intense because the currency collapses, and then the debt becomes completely unaffordable, and debtors are out of tons of money, and local companies go bankrupt, and it's just a giant mess. And yet we did it all over again over the last few years, this time with Eastern Europe as opposed to Latin America, but the same set of abuses and mistakes were made.
Do you view there'll be any repercussions against the United States as far as trusting in the dollar? Do you think there's going to be a new financial system?
No. In fact, what's funny, if you look at the path of the dollar over the last 2.5 years, it kind of peaked out about 2005. And actually, it had come down a little bit, but really had peaked out maybe 2003, had been flat, slightly coming down to 2005. And then from 2000 and late 2005 all the way through about the third quarter of 2008, the dollar just dropped 20% or so, really gone down quite a bit, 25% maybe. And that's when a lot of people were talking about, well, the dollar is finished, you know, the U.S. is no longer the center of the world economy, everybody's going to start holding euros or yuans. And then what happened? And then the problems that we saw in the U.S. economy spread to the rest of the world. And England started nationalizing banks, and Spain is bailing out banks. And there's just, stock markets from Russia to China to Indonesia all across the board collapsed. And what happened to the U.S. dollar? It took back everything it had given over the previous 2 years. Our dollar went up to 2005 levels.
Does that mean it's healthy or is good by comparison?
That's because we are good by comparison. Because if nothing else, in the U.S., you know what you're getting. We have financial markets that are large. There's lots of financial assets. If you're going to buy government debt anywhere in the world, you buy U.S. government debt because our government is considered to be the safest government to buy debt from across the globe because we're just so big. So in a sense, all the talk about the U.S. being down and out was talk. The fact is we're still the financial center of the world, and people immediately started rushing to put their dollars here when times got bad. Now, the funny part of that, or not so funny, I guess, as the case may be, is that we had, you know, remember, the NBER recently came out and said that this economy was in a recession since December of 2007.
Yeah, thanks for the warning. I've 12 months in arrears.
Well, but that's what they do. You know, they always get a bad time for being backcasters by telling us what already happened. But they don't pretend to be forecasters. They simply interpret the data. They don't try to predict the data.
Okay.
But be that as it may, you know, one of the questions has been, well, if that's the case, why didn't we see GDP contract in a sharper basis through 2008? And the answer, of course, is because of that declining dollar. We saw pretty not dramatic declines, but we saw declines in domestic demand. But foreign demand for our exports picked up enough that it really created growth in the U.S. economy despite the weak fundamentals here. But, of course, when the dollar started going back up again, that game was over.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you saw the exports really start to fall off dramatically. And as a result of that, we no longer have the benefit of world demand to try to pull us out of this mess we're in.
The $700 billion bailout bill, the way we spent the first $350 billion, do you think that was the best use for it?
For what the money was intended for, absolutely.
Really?
You know, Congress is getting all upset, right? There's no accountability, they said. And what are they doing? They're giving it to banks, and the banks are supposed to lend it, and they're not lending it, and that's a terrible thing. This is a complete and utter misinterpretation of what the TARP was meant for. There was nothing in the TARP that said this was to get banks to lend to people, yet again. There was nothing in the TARP that said that this money should be accounted for, or it should go to GM, or should go here or there to rescue this company, that company. The TARP money was for one thing and one thing only, and that was to stabilize the banking system. The banking system, of course, is in a terrible shape. What you have in the U.S. economy was an enormous increase in asset values over the course of the last decade or so.
Mm-hmm.
So an enormous increase in that. It's not just real estate. It's commercial real estate. It's land. It's mutual funds. It's hedge funds. It's debt across the board, a giant increase in asset values. And banks lent against that like they never had before. The banks, you saw a huge increase in credit. Now, on the back end of that, what you have, of course, is a collapse in those asset values. And as a result of that, the debt, the sort of delinquencies on debt banks are holding is going up through the roof in every single classification of debt. Banks will easily lose $1 trillion to $2 trillion on the loans they've lent out over the last few years as these things shake out. Well, the entire equity of the banking system is like what was about $1.5 trillion a year and a half ago.
Okay.
So what does this mean? That means these loan losses will eventually wipe out the entire equity of the banking system. You can't have that happen. You just can't. I mean, we tried to let the market fix the banking system back in 1930.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't work out so well for us.
Okay.
So the idea here, and I know that a lot of people get upset about this, and I understand why they're upset, that this idea that we're bailing the banks out of their own bad decisions, and that shouldn't happen, right? I mean, we live in a capitalist society, which means if you make a bad decision, you should suffer the consequences, i.e. bankruptcy. But you can't do that. The banking system is special. It provides lubrication that keeps the economy running. And from that perspective, we have to step in and we have to help these banks recover because we just can't allow them to fail left, right, and center. Now, the initial TARP program, I did not like it all. I was extremely upset about the initial TARP because what they were going to do is go and overpay for assets, which I just thought was not what they needed to be doing.
Now, don't you get the sense that they may, in fact, do that with the second pile?
Well, we'll see. We'll see how it works.
Okay.
I hope not. Like, I really like the way they've been doing it. And the way they've been doing it is by taking hunks of this equity and supplying it not just to any bank or anybody willing to sell an asset, but they're giving it primarily to banks under what you might want to call two classifications. They're giving it to banks that are, like it or not, too big to fail. We just can't have a Citigroup or a Bank of America roll over at this point in time. They think, I don't know if it's true or not, but they think it would be too damaging to the economy. You know, the mindset in Washington, D.C. was that letting Lehman fail was a big mistake.
Yes.
I don't know why they think that, but they think that. And so the mentality is they're not going to let any of these big, big banks fail one way or the other. Now, the second thing they need to be thinking about there is small banks they want to give money to. In that circumstance, they've been, I think, a little bit more judicious about who's gotten the money. The idea has been to find the banks that are healthy, that haven't indulged in this speculative debt frenzy, and given them the cash to allow them to kind of expand their balance sheets. And the idea there is not just to loan to people, but rather that they have the liquidity that allow them to sort of pick up other banks as other banks start to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have 8,000 banks in the U.S. economy, and I think if you read through the text, you read between the lines, what they're really saying is in a year and a half, we want to see 4,000 banks in the U.S. economy. We want these guys to fail. We don't want this massive horde of banks. It's out of control. We want to see massive consolidation. We want to see the small banks that made bad decisions to simply get wiped out. And what we need to do is put money into the system through these equity injections in such a way as to smooth this process and allow the credit environment to continue operating even as we move through this sort of tough time.
You talked about a $7 trillion problem, and we're throwing $700 billion at it. Does that mean you think that there's going to be additional funds that will exceed what?
Actually, I said it was a $1 to $2 trillion problem.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The banking sector, not seven. It's about $1 to $2 trillion. And so far, they've lobbed, $300 million at it.
Okay, I misunderstood.
And, the problem that I foresee is this next $350 billion, one of the big questions is will it actually go to the banks, or is Congress going to be picking it apart and doing what they want with it? I was pleased to see that Obama had gotten the money with relatively few caveats. Whenever you see a pile of cash that big there, every politician in the world is going to start trying to fill up their particular pork project.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too tempting. They can't help themselves.
What's the source of all that money? How is that raised, and how ultimately will it have to be paid back?
That's just pure borrowing. That's the country going out and selling treasury bonds, which are in high demand right now. It's interesting. We have a government that failed to regulate the markets properly, created a huge financial crisis, and as a result of that, as a result of the huge financial crisis, there's such fear out there that they could borrow at this incredibly cheap rate and turn around and try to fix the problem they caused in the first place. The irony of how economies work, I think, is always quite humorous.
Are they borrowing these on 90-day notes or 10-year notes?
Some combination of the above, some 1 year, some 3 months, some 10 years. It's really across the board.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a lot of fungibility there, too. Don't forget that the government in general is reliant upon borrowing at this point in time because of the massive fiscal deficit that we have had in place since, of course, George Bush's term in office began.
We got about a minute and a half. Now, in the future, let's say we really build a budget deficit in excess of $1 trillion a year for a while. Interest rates may someday return to a more normal, let's say, even 6%, it would be hard to imagine not having a $1 trillion deficit once you have a $15 trillion total deficit. Is that going to be something we deal with, and will that affect the inflation?
Well, two things to keep in mind. First of all, the numbers aren't quite that horrendous. Let's say that we go through this $800 billion program that they're talking about on top of the $700 billion that's already in place, plus some other money that's been kicking around. Perhaps $2 trillion in additional borrowing, maybe $2.5 trillion once you add in the fiscal deficit that we're going to see. Now, what does that mean? Well, that brings the sort of national deficit from about $9 trillion in total to about $11.5 trillion total. In other words, another way of thinking about it is that $2.5 trillion they're going to borrow is about 15% of GDP. It's not that much money.
Okay.
It seems like a lot.
It's all relative to what you have to work with, I guess.
It is. And,
okay.
And it's something that if as long as we have the political courage to turn around in 2 years when everything's fixed and we're over this hump to raise taxes and pay the debt off, it shouldn't be an issue.
Okay.
What worries me is not the borrowing. It's the fact that whoever is in power in 2 years is not going to have the incentive to turn around and pay it back. When you think about what happened in World War II.
I tell you what, let's pick up right where we are in our next segment, okay?
Absolutely.
We've unfortunately run out of time. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Thornburg, and we'll pick it up in next week.
That sounds great.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.